it's made my life worth living. The road was my life because I drove a truck for, oh, I don't know, 20 years of my life, maybe more. And so I earned a living on the road. And when there wasn't a steering wheel in front of me, when I just had two wheels beneath me, the road became fun. It wasn't work anymore. It gives me a reason to live. It's everything. It's been everything since I was 9 years old and got a little model of a Harley-Davidson electric glide, till now being 55 and having a shed with a lot of motorbikes that when it's freezing cold, I just love to look at them. When they break, I like to work on them. And when the weather's good, I ride them. So it's everything. It's everything to me.
And that was the voice of author Graham Field. And this is Ted Kettler, your host here on the Motorcycle Man Podcast. And welcome to episode 277.
It's Motorcycle Man.
In this segment of chapters, we have author and traveler Graham Field, and he joins us to give us a preview of day 28 from his book, In Search of Greener Grass. But first, the Motorcycle Man Podcast is brought to you by Scorpion Helmets. They offer high-quality, innovative, technical apparel and helmets at an incredible value. So to learn more, you go visit ScorpionUSA.com. And, of course, Shinko Tires. Now, Shinko has a tire to suit your needs and riding style without breaking your bank account. So go to Shinko Tire USA and make sure you tell them that the Motorcycle Men Podcast sent you. And Wild Ass Seats. Hey, you can improve your comfort and ability to stay in the saddle longer with a cushion from Wild Ass Seats. So if you are tired of those painful pressure points and fatigue, go to wild-ass.com and get your cushion today. And make sure you tell them that the Motorcycle Men sent you on over there. Now listen, for the best in casual riding gear for men and women, there's only one place you should be going, and that is Tobacco Motorwear. Go visit them at tobaccomotorwear.com, and our listeners will get 10% off your order when you use that coupon code MOTOMEN. And make sure you say you want to get in Dave's pants. That's very important. So Tobacco Motorwear, go check them out. And, of course, Uclear Helmet Communication Systems. Now, they're based on feedback from riders, dealers, and industry experts to be the most advanced and easiest to use, most durable, longest-lasting, and weatherproof comm system ever. It's got cutting-edge tech, is made simple to use while being rugged enough to withstand any weather conditions and any terrain. So go ride with Uclear's DynaMesh-compatible intercom. You get powerful music, crystal-clear phone calls on any road and on any trail, and you're going to love the audio, the best audio available in any system. To learn more, you go to uclearddigital.com, and you tell them that the Motorcycle Men Podcast sent you. Now, let's get on with chapters. All right, and welcome back to the podcast. Graham, welcome back to the show, sir. How are you?
I'm good, Ted. Good to be back. Thank you very much for inviting me again.
I really appreciate you getting on here so we can talk about this little introduction to your book. So for those not familiar with who you are, why don't you tell us who you are and what you do?
Who am I? My name is Graham Field. Motorcycles have always been my life. In 2010... I did quite a big motorcycle trip solo to Mongolia and beyond. And that sort of kind of got me into the motorcycle scene more as a name, I suppose. God, I hate to use that terminology. But now I do podcasts. I do work for Adventure Bike TV. I write columns. I've got four books out. So I suppose I tell tales of travel. I try to inform, encourage, inspire, and generally like to share my life on two wheels and the places they've taken me.
That, and you do that very well, by the way.
Oh, well, thank you. I'd like to share.
Okay. So In Search of Greener Grass was a book of a trip you did to Mongolia, of all places. So why don't you tell us how that journey came about?
Well, without really telling you what the book's about, I was on a TV game show in the UK. And to get on that TV game show, you had to fill out an application form. And one of the questions, inevitably, was, what would you do if you won a large sum of money? So I wrote, at the time, The Long Way Round, you know, Ewan and Charlie's Long Way Round was very big. Mm-hmm. And I said, I would do a trip that would make Charlie and Ewan's look like a trip to the grocery store. And then they said that on the show. You can still see the YouTube, see it on YouTube by my website. So I said something like that. And so he asked, you know, the host said, so Mongolia, why Mongolia? And I clearly didn't have a bloody clue why I would go, what I would see, what I would need to do for it. But having it been aired on national British TV, I sort of felt a bit obligated to do it. And I didn't win a lot of money. So I bought about a KLR650, which cost me about $1,000. I had about $7,000 money to do a trip. And I just thought, well, if I head east, maybe I'll get there. And so I set off east to Mongolia, under-researched, unprepared, under-financed, and just to see what would happen, really.
So, which brings me to the next question, and I find it funny that you say you do a little preparation, but describe for us the route and whatever preparation you may have done.
Well, east, really, that was the route. I'd done motorcycle trips before. I'd ridden around the States. I'd gone from Colorado up to Alaska. So I wasn't new to it, but this was big. This involved visas. This involved foreign languages. This involved being totally on my own. So I spent a lot of time on Horizons Unlimited and on some forums trying to research. But I think, as anybody will tell you, there comes a point where you just get paralyzed by information because no one can agree on anything.
No, you're right.
It still makes me laugh on these forums when people say, oh, you know, hard or soft panniers, what tires? It's, oh, for Christ's sake.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I did say, but go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, go on.
Go on.
No, I don't even know what I was going to say.
I did notice that in your book that making stops at heavy metal festivals was a priority.
It was a very tactical part of the plan, because to leave your driveway thinking you're going to ride to Mongolia is very, very daunting. But to think I'm just going to a metal festival in Sweden, that was far more easy to cope with. I was going to meet some friends, see some familiar bands in an environment where I feel very comfortable. And so that was all I had to think about. So it was like chunking the journey, you know. So, yeah, that was what it was. It was off to go bang me head in the Swedish metal festival.
So what other challenges did you face along the way? I'm sure there were many, but did you have a favorite part of the trip?
Well, the challenges, I suppose, are the challenges any solo traveler would experience. I mean, little things which people who travel as pairs would never think about. For example, when you're trying to find a room, you have to leave everything unattended on the bike whilst you go into that hotel reception.
Yes.
Or something like that. Even going to an ATM can be a problem because you've got your back to your bike. ATMs are generally in sort of more crowded places, pedestrian places. So little things like that are a challenge. There's the inevitable mechanical issues. I've got a reasonable mechanical knowledge, a dangerous mechanical knowledge, enough to be confident, but not enough to have ability.
I've never heard it referred to that way, but I like that.
So there were challenges. Like, as I said earlier, I've always been a truck driver, so used to my own company. I've always worked alone. So the loneliness wasn't really a huge deal. Company inevitably comes. Not necessarily on cue, but you're never totally alone, not forever. Russia was hard. It was tough. Cyrillic alphabet, tough language. So there were definitely challenges. But what I loved, the rewards, were, for me, where I came from in Essex in England, I don't live there anymore, was it was so crowded, so populated. If you look at one of those atlases of the world with a population graph, the most densely populated places are normally in red, like New York City or Bangladesh. Well, the area I came from was also in red, so very high density population.
Yeah.
For me, I love wide open spaces. Mongolia's got a lot of that, as did Kazakhstan. And so the real elation, the real thing for me was when I stop somewhere on the Kazakhstan steppe at night and look around 360 degrees, and there was no sign of human inhabitants. Someone could have stood there 1,000 years ago and it wouldn't have looked any different. And that's what I love. That's what really thrills me, to be absolutely out there in the middle of nowhere, not necessarily surrounded by beautiful nature, but surrounded by nothing. I love that.
That is wonderful. That kind of thing I would love to experience. Was it your intention from the beginning to make an audiobook out of this, or make a book out of this period?
No, there's some terrible squeaking there, Ted.
Yeah, let me ask that again. Was it your intention from the very beginning to make a book out of this adventure?
No, not at all. I mean, I've always kept a diary for over half my life. For over 30 years, every single day of my life is documented. Wow. Always kept a diary. So I've always written. And in the early days when I used to travel, I used to write a mass mail to friends. Then that's sort of progressed to a blog, although it didn't happen until after the book, actually. But I've always heard, oh, you should write a book, you should write a book. Of course, I never did. But I remember it quite clearly, having actually made it into Mongolia, and feeling that it was really quite an achievement given the bike I was on, the budget that I had. And I was thinking, you know, actually, this could be quite entertaining. This could probably be a book. And it came to me, the title came to me, In Search of Greener Grass, which I really was, because I was traveling off to find a better life. And at the same time, across the Mongolian steppe, you know, there's a lot of grassland. And it just came to me and I thought, man, that's good. And it took 3 days to find a place with internet so I could Google it and see if anybody else had used it. And they hadn't. It was all mine. Someone had already used my name, but I can't rechange that. The damn healthcare product took place in Texas. It always come up first hit when you do a Google search. Anyway, In Search of Greener Grass was the title. And when I got back from the trip, I have my diary, so I had it all written down already. And it was really quite easy because all the books I've written are all in diary format. So it's not, again, like a journey, it's not so daunting to think, look at the end, which seems so far away. I'm simply doing it a day at a time. So I think the reader enjoys it because they're traveling with me, and it's easy to write because all I'm doing is a day at a time. And it became a book, and people seem to like it, which is a bonus.
Yeah. Now, when you were writing in your diary, would you stop along the way and say, I have to make an entry in my diary because I will forget this? Did you have to do that?
No, because I carry a voice recorder. I generally, whenever I can, ride in fingerless gloves. I like the dexterity. So unless it's super cold. I generally have fingerless gloves, but not just the voice recorder, so I can grab the camera and get those shots really quickly. So in my tank bag on the left side is a voice recorder, and when I have those inspired thoughts or observations or whatever, I can speak into that. And then later, when I'm writing the diary, it's not just what I have to say, but it's the way I say it, because I can tell in my voice whether I'm pissed off, whether I'm elated, whether I'm bored, whatever. So the voice recorder tells you a lot when you go back to record in word what you've said in your voice recorder.
Right. Now, with regard to that, what made you decide to make it an audiobook?
A lot of people would ask, you know, when I do the shows and stuff, a lot of people say, you know, is there an audio version? Is there an audio version? It really wasn't on my radar because it's quite expensive to do one.
Right.
And I can't read. So it happened in the gap. After I'd written 3 books, there was a lull before I wrote anything else. And so it seemed like a good time to reformat and repackage the same shit and sell it again. So consequently, went into a studio and or at least contacted the studio and had a test reading first.
Sure.
To see if it could actually work and if he could work with me, because the guy who recorded it has been in the business for years, been on the road, toured with bands. His studio, the walls are just adorned with backstage passes. Have really, you know, well-recognized bands, and the only one I can think of off the top of my head was Boney M. But I'm pretty sure that wasn't the highlight of his career.
Now,
very experienced man. And also luckily into motorbikes as well. It turned out that he agreed to work with me, which again wasn't probably the highlight of his career either. But we arranged to, and it takes a long time. It takes about a week. I'm in a 7-day week of about 8 to 10 hour days in the studio, sitting in a recording booth, which is no bigger than a telephone box, with a microphone in front of you. And I generate so much heat when I'm reading, from concentration. I tend to move my arms as well when I'm doing it, because moving an arm sort of works like a pendulum, and it sort of gives you a rhythm to your reading. So I'm quite active in this little booth and generate a lot of heat, and it's not a pleasant environment.
With regard to that, what made you decide to narrate the audiobook yourself?
Trying to employ someone to do it was out of the question.
Oh, yeah.
It was done on quite a tight budget. But apart from that, I don't think anybody can tell your story like you can. I mean, I always have an audiobook on the go. I've listened to hundreds.
Oh,
and
yeah.
My favorite ones are the ones which are narrated by the writer.
Yes.
They're not all like Genghis Khan's one. That wasn't done by him. But a lot of them are. I just think it adds another dimension to it, because it was my story, and I know where the emphasis is, and how I want to say stuff. And no matter how well you can write something, you can't necessarily portray the mood in the word. One of the huge bonuses of the audiobook is you can put that emphasis in your voice.
Oh, yeah.
For the situation you're describing. And I mean, for example, I recently listened to Rob Halford's from Judas Priest. I listened to his audiobook, and it was pretty good insofar that he's very down to earth, from Midlands in England. Very matter of fact. I mean, a lot of the rock bands, metal bands came from that place, for Black Sabbath days, Osbourne does. So it bred a lot of bands, and they've all got this sort of Midlands accent, which is just an unassuming accent. But you could tell when he was talking about something that he was passionate about, and when he was just reading the words. Sometimes there was no expression, there was no elation, he wasn't there. And then other points in the book, he was, and you could really feel it. And I think that's the trick. If we are reading your own story, is to recall it as you're telling it, and give it as much emphasis as you can.
Right, and as you had said earlier, with the use of the voice recorder that you used, you were able to speak, and the agitation or happiness or whatever would come through your voice, then you would know how to translate that. So by narrating it yourself, you're able to also translate that feeling. And you did very well, by the way.
Well, I hope so. If someone else could have read it better, then they would have cost me a lot of money. The funny thing is, with the audiobooks I listen to, I listen to, for example, one of my favorites is Keith Richards' autobiography, Life, and it's read by Johnny Depp. And I'd be listening to that and thinking, yeah, I'm gonna do it like Johnny Depp's voice. That's really cool, Or I'd listen to John Cleese from Monty Python and listen to the inflections in his voice and think, yeah, that's good. I'm gonna do it like that. And I'd be listening to this as I walked to the studio in the morning from my Airbnb, thinking, yep, I'm gonna sound like cool. And I get in the studio and it's just me. It's
and then you sound
voice.
Like Graham Field, right?
Uncannily so.
That's pretty funny. It's funny that you should mention that Johnny Depp read Keith Richards' book when Keith Richards played Jack Sparrow's father in the movies.
That's right. That's how they got to know each other, and that's why he asked Johnny Depp to do it. Yeah.
That's funny. So now, how was the recording process of the book? Did you enjoy doing it?
Yes and no. I mean, the first day is pretty cool. I mean, you're a musician, but for me to be in a studio with a mixer board with all these levers and everything, all these little dials, it's pretty cool. It was pretty rock and roll. But that lasted for about 20 minutes. then I went in my room, and it is hard. I mean, I would get up about 4 a.m. and read through everything I intended to read in the studio that day, so I was familiar with it. You have to repunctuate everything because there are a lot more pauses. You don't record like you read, and you put you pause when there aren't commas. It's quite a different way of doing it. And So there's a lot of alterations to the script before you read it. So I have familiarized. See, it's really tricky. Familiarize myself with that. And then, like I say, it's very intense in the studio. The guy who I worked with was so patient. And really, that was his biggest accolade. Because if he'd have said, oh, for Christ's sake, you've screwed up again, then you could be pretty certain I'd screw it up again, because now I was nervous and intimidated. But he was so unbelievably patient. So when I messed things up, and I did it frequently, we just rewound to the beginning of that sentence and on we would go.
Yeah.
So it's intense. And this huge pile of paper, which is your manuscript that you're reading from, slowly, day by day, decreases. And you try not to rush it. Oh, get near the end, you know?
Yeah.
And you've got to keep that pendulum going. And also, the change in voice, and this is something else I noticed now in audiobooks, you can tell when the narrator has gone and had his lunch and come back, or gone home for the day and come back, because you can hear it in the voice.
Right.
And it's so difficult to do. Because I thought, before I'd gone and done it, I thought, this is great, I'll take the bottle of whiskey in with me, I'll have a little sip now and again. It doesn't work like that.
No. So you didn't actually read the book. You actually developed some sort of a manuscript to read from.
Well, not only can you not read the book, but I print it out on A4 in quite big font, so it's easy to follow.
Sure.
And also because the end of every sheet has to end with a period, with a full stop, because there's going to be the sound in the microphone of you turning the page.
Or, of course.
And he can just very easily edit that out. If the page stopped mid-sentence, it'd be a lot harder to do. So, yes, your book has to be rewritten to fit on A4. That people have... You spoke to Jackie, didn't you, I think? Jackie Furno?
No, not yet.
Haven't you? Oh, well, anyway, I think she did it with a Kindle. So, of course, there are no pages turning.
Right.
But I've never even held a Kindle in my hand. I wouldn't even know how it begins. So, so consequently, I did it the manual way.
Now, were you able to record... like, how many chapters a day would you do?
God, I don't know. I mean, we record for 8 hours. And really, he knew when I was done, you know, because the mistakes were becoming faster and faster. And, you know, he'd try different tactics, stopping for lunch, stopping for biscuits, stopping for a coffee. And when nothing else works, he'd say, well, let's wrap it up for today.
Wow. You see, this is an interesting insight into the process of creating an audiobook, which a lot of people don't know.
Well, I don't think any of us work well when we're tired. And, you know, when I used to sort of do painting and decorating, you know, if someone said, oh, the can you just, I used to hate it, the can you just, you know, you've timed your journey, you've timed your job, and you finish it, oh, can you just? Well, I can, but I'll probably fuck it up because I'm really tired. So
that's
and
perfect.
It's the same in anything, particularly when recording. I don't know if you feel it as a musician, but there comes a point when you're just not producing quality of work anymore.
That's right. Yeah, you just get fatigued, and mentally you're just not there anymore, you know. And you just have to say, you know what, let me get walk away from it, and I'll come back when my head's clear and we'll start fresh.
Yeah,
that's exactly the way you have to do it. So now tell our listeners what we're about to hear. And this is day 28 of In Search of Greener Grass.
This was in Russia, and it was supposed to be an easy day, and it would have been if I hadn't taken the wrong turning. But I did take the wrong turn. It took me through some incredibly hostile territory, and I was really quite afraid. And what I was seeing didn't do anything to calm me. And it was such a challenging day, unrideable tracks of ruts and mud, dried mud, and no direction, and run out of fuel, and generally just a disastrous day. I think Ted Simon once said, as a writer, the worst it gets, the better it is. That's no consolation. That is no consolation at the time. And it was a dreadful day, which I got through, and I suppose makes you stronger, and certainly gives you hopefully a compelling and entertaining chapter. But it was a tough day. I hadn't had much company for a while, so I was already sort of questioning my sanity. And at the end of that day, I really don't know if I ever got it back.
All
right. So that's kind of what you're going to be hearing.
All right. Well, Graham, I appreciate you come on here and give us a little preview of the whole process and this chapter that we're about to listen to. Thank you very much for your time, and I hope to talk to you again very soon. Well, we're going to have you back. We're going to have you back on for your other books, though.
Okay. Well, cool. Looking forward to it, and hope you enjoy this one.
Thank you, sir.
Cheers. Bye.
Day 28, Askatran, Russia, 447 miles. I'm woken by two stray dogs outside my tent. I instinctively sit up and growl at them, and they run off. Would seem I'm in need of some human company. I'm turning into Dr. Doolittle. It's a nice, easy day, 400 kilometers to Askatran. Then I will take the day off before crossing into Kazakhstan. I definitely picked the right place to stop for the night. The landscape quickly changes to flat, arable farmland. Even if I had found somewhere to pitch a tent, I wouldn't have been hidden. And it clearly rained a lot heavier here than it did where I stayed. But that was yesterday's luck. The crops have all been harvested, fields ploughed. I wonder what the farmers do now. It's only the beginning of July. The sporadic sign posted has got me again. Somehow, I've managed to leave the main road. This is pointed out to me at today's first checkpoint, but they show me an alternative route on my map. No worries. I can go up the side of the Volga Delta. It's as broad as it is long. Those lazy farmers certainly haven't bothered to irrigate this land in their spare time. It's hot, barren, deserted plains. I have a slight feeling of recollection in my head, but trying to recall adequate information is futile. If I could find some shade, I would stop and check my book. There is no shade, no trees, nothing. But I'm getting a niggling feeling, so I stop anyway. The Lonely Planet certainly can't be accused of overrating this area. Well, this ought to keep the backpackers away. In a box section, I read snippets like, an area of political unrest, like walking in a minefield, pleasant until you take the wrong step. Weekly reports of shootings, bombings and kidnappings, particularly foreigners, who fetch a higher price. Oh, great. And all I have to protect me is a throttle, an offensive smell and phone reception. I decide to use one of my weapons immediately. I text a friend and tell him where I am, where I'm going, and that I will be safe in 2 hours, when I will definitely text him again. Everywhere is deserted. Petrol stations are abandoned, and have been for some time. Hoses ripped from the pumps. What houses there are either boarded up or in ruins. It's a little scary. The few vehicles I see have number plates from places like North Ossetia, Azerbaijan, Georgia. Names I know from news reports and not from holiday programs. The cyclist I met in Sochi said he was going to be coming this way, or so he thought. Those smiling officials at the checkpoint had different uniforms on. Were they leading me astray on purpose? There are yellow signs on the side of the road. What do they say? A warning? Danger signs? Probably best I can't read them. I haven't seen yellow signs before. I could have turned around. I'm not sure why I didn't. Perhaps I didn't want to lose face at the checkpoint. No other reason comes to mind. If you're going to go through hell, it's probably best to keep going. I dare not trust any more officials. But if I keep riding when I'm waved at to be stopped, will I be shot in the back? If I do stop, will I be mugged or worse? In the heat haze ahead, two trucks are stopped on either side of the road. I watch a single figure walk across the road. An ambush? I pass at full speed. No wire has been strung across the road at neck height. I'm suspicious of everything now. On top of all this heat and fear, the sky is full of locusts and crickets, and they splat big yellow pus over my screen, which I cower behind. They hit like hailstones on my legs. I find a petrol station. It stands alone, but is operational and open. There are several men standing around their parked cars, excitedly studying a map. Are they discussing no-go areas? I keep my helmet on. If I'm thinking this is disguising my nationality, I've not considered my bike with its British plates and Union Jack sticker. In my alarm state, I miscalculate the amount of petrol I need and don't get a full tank. You have to pay first for the amount of fuel you require. I have enough now to get me out at full throttle, which isn't much more than 70 miles an hour. I long for my Triumph for the first time this trip, which could get me out of here at 140 miles an hour. I'm overtaken by a tinted window Mercedes with no plates or form of identification. I reach the T-junction, and I'm halfway. A few huts are all that depict a village. I hurtle north. I'm so thirsty, but dare not stop to drink. There is nothing around, just hot, parched land. Why will people fight over land like this? Or perhaps the fighting left the once fertile land this way. With a second's warning, the dots ahead become another storm of locusts, and they hit like golf balls on my perfectly positioned windshield. The impact is loud, and I feel the spray of their yellow innards touching my dry, cracking lips, exposed through an open visor. Even if I dared to stop, I could not capture this on a photograph. To anybody who wasn't here, it's just barren desert. But in this moment, in this environment, knowing what I've read, paranoid of every vehicle, and having seen evidence of once inhabited places, there is doubtlessly trouble here. I'm not sure how serious or how recent, but it looks like a war zone to me. When I come to the river and the checkpoint, I'm sure my relief is evident. Yes, I was scared, but in fairness, most of that yellow is from the splattered locusts. I was informed and scared, not just cowardly. I'm back in stable Russia. I'm greeted with a gold-toothed smile. Is he saying, congratulations, you are safe? No. The official has some bad news. The road is no more. I have to take a different route. I will now be taking the third side of a rectangle, a total of an extra 300 kilometres. It's so hot. I stop in the shade of an abandoned petrol station's canopy. Something catches my eye. Is that a big bird nesting in the top of the building? Or is someone looking at me? I take bread and sausage out of my hot panniers. I eat, rehydrate, and feed a stray dog. Then text my friend. I'm still alive. And safe. I picture his Saturday morning routine. Fresh orange juice on the patio. Planet Rock on the radio. The bright green of his postage stamp lawn, surrounded by the privacy of woven fence panels. Well, I'm not bored anymore. Careful what you wish for. I wonder if he has any comprehension of what I just rode through. Do I, for that matter? Was my fear justified? Was his complacency? Okay, deep breaths. Let's get this over with. I ride a few more miles, and then the road just ends. What the fuck? It turns to not just dirt, but deep ruts and sand, as far as I can see. I can't ride this. It must be wrong. I go back to the tarmac. But the only other choice is to go into what is a village. So I go back to the dirt track. My compass says west. I want north, or at least northwest. It's not a matter of how many times I nearly drop the bike. It's constant. I'm not riding. I'm balancing. It's a continued struggle to keep it upright. I can't do this. I turn back again. I've been riding 8 hours in extreme heat now. There is no one around. I'm not sure if that's good or bad. I usually see some kids come running out to see the source of the single cylinder exhaust note. There is a fisherman by a small stagnant pond. I show him my map. He points to the village. I ride round the dusty tracks of the abandoned mud and tiled houses and find a hard road. There is a broken down truck with its bonnets up. The driver is pouring water into a steaming radiator. I can't get enough confirmation at this point. He's likely to be more informed than the fisherman. He indicates this is the right road, but that it will turn to dirt. He is right, but at least it's level dirt. I reduce my tire pressures, and it's not too bad at all. I take it easy. It takes a lot of concentration, and I'm already mentally exhausted from today's events. Eventually, the surface turns to tarmac again, and unexpectedly, the bike coughs. I've used up my tank of panic pump petrol. I only have about 10 miles on reserve. I've been doing 30 miles an hour in third gear. Yep, that makes sense. I find a small village. A Chinese-looking person is wandering about. I point at my tank. I need petrol. He points at a container. No, mate, I don't want to ship it home. But sure enough, inside the 20-foot container is a petrol pump. And across from it is a hut with a mirror window. A grumpy Mongolian woman with gold teeth sits inside. I can picture her now. But if the window was mirrored and she didn't smile, how do I know she had gold teeth? I do recall she didn't seem nearly as pleased to see me as I was to see her. It's a Mongolian village. It's amazing. Even the roofs are turned up like Chinese roofs. I could take some photos of my bike in front of them and then go on the beach for 3 months. Just tell everyone I made it to Mongolia. There is a completely different vibe here. I like it. I stop at a little shop for water. It feels fine to leave my bike unattended as I go into the shop. People still stare, but it's not threatening or intrusive. It's gentle and inquisitive, the Buddhist nature. I really love the adventure of this wild open space. I have a full tank and supplies again. The discomfort of today's distance is of minor concern with so many distractions. The unknown, new experiences. This is why I came. It just took 4,000 miles to get to it. I get some brief cloud cover before the overexposed plains again. And then I'm back on the right road, the one I accidentally split from this morning. I still have over 200 kilometres to go. That was one hell of a diversion. I see a signpost in English. It says Moscow, 1,700 kilometres away. But more important, Atari is mentioned. My first evidence of Kazakhstan. Now that's really exciting. So finally, after over 700 kilometres, I get to Astrakhan. 12 hours. It should have been 5 hours and 400 kilometres. But what an adventure. I can't find a hotel. I'm so hot. So tired. I ride round and round the town. This is when accidents happen. After an hour of stop-start traffic lights and false hope, I find one. It's expensive, but justifiably so. The woman opens the big metal gates for me to bring my bike in, but she can't lock them again. I help her line them up, and she slides the metal bolt into my thumb full force. It bursts and bleeds instantly. The entire road, all those dangers, and it's the hotel that breaks my skin. She rushes me to a sink, puts iodine on the gaping wound, and puts on a bandage. It's so big it looks like a cartoon throbbing thumb. It almost hurts as much as I make out it did. I take a shower and wash away a day of fear, mystery, and excitement, while she cooks me a meal made of pork and guilt and brings it to my room. Those are the days that stay with you, the tales they want to hear when you get home. But I could never make them really understand. It's personal. That's why I'm here.
And that was day 28 from Graham Field's book, In Search of Greener Grass. And the Motorcycle Men podcast is supporting David's Dream and Believe Cancer Foundation. To learn more, you can go to davidsdreamandbelieve.org to donate and see your money go to a cause that actually makes a difference. And, of course, the Gold Star Ride Foundation, they're helping families of fallen soldiers. So if you would like to be a part of a great cause and get some heartfelt miles in, go to goldstarride.org to donate and learn how you can participate in the next Gold Star Ride. Thank you for joining me and Graham here on the Motorcycle Men podcast. This has been Chapters with Graham Field and Day 28 from In Search of Greener Grass. Links to Graham's books will be in the show notes and, of course, on the Motorcycle Men website at motorcyclemen.us. And don't forget to go over to the Motorcycle Men YouTube channel, which has now been changed to Ride with Ted. Now, there'll still be things about the Motorcycle Men podcast in there, but primarily it's called Ride with Ted. And, of course, there'll be Ted Shed videos in there as well. There is a new video coming very shortly, so please go over there, check that out, subscribe, and check out all those videos. And for the rest of the Motorcycle Men team, I want to thank you for listening. And remember, boys and girls, we say stupid crap here, so you don't have to. Ride safely, kids.